The devastating defeat by Napoleon at Jena triggered the so-called Prussian Reform Movement, a transformation which replaced cabinet rule by appointees of the national leader with rule by permanent civil servants and permanent government bureaus. Ask yourself which form of governance responds better to public opinion, and you will realize what a radical chapter in European affairs was opened. The familiar three-tier system of education emerged in the Napoleonic era, one private tier, two government ones. At the top, one half of 1% of the students attended Akademienschulen, where, as future policymakers, they learned to think strategically, contextually, in wholes. They learned complex processes and useful knowledge, studied history, wrote copiously, argued often, read deeply, and mastered tasks of command. The next level, Realschulen, was intended mostly as a manufactory for the professional proletariat of engineers, architects, doctors, lawyers, career civil servants, and other such assistants as policy thinkers at times would require. From 5 to 7.5% of all students attended these real schools, learning in a superficial fashion how to think in context, but mostly learning how to manage materials, men, and situations, to be problem solvers. This group would also staff the various policing functions of the state, bringing order to the domain. Finally, at the bottom of the pile, a group between 92 and 94% of the population attended people's schools, where they learned obedience, cooperation, and correct attitudes, along with the rudiments of literacy and official state myths of history. This universal system of compulsion schooling was up and running by 1819 and soon became the eighth wonder of the world, promising for a brief time, in spite of its exclusionary layered structure, liberal education for all. But this early dream was soon abandoned. This particular utopia had a different target than human equality. It aimed instead for frictionless efficiency. From its inception, the Volksschulen, the people's place, heavily discounted reading. Reading produced dissatisfaction, it was thought. The bell school remedy was called for. A standard of virtual illiteracy formally taught under state church auspices. Reading offered too many windows onto better lives, too much familiarity with better ways of thinking. It was a gift unwise to share with those permanently consigned to low station. Heinrich Pestalozzi, an odd Swiss-German school reformer, was producing at this time a non-literary, experience-based pedagogy, strong in music and industrial arts, which was attracting much favorable attention in Prussia. Here seemed to be a way to keep the poor happy without arousing in them hopes of dramatically changing the social order. Pestalozzi claimed the ability to mold the poor to accept all the efforts peculiar to their class. He offered them love in place of ambition. By employing psychological means in the training of the young, class warfare might be avoided. A curiously prophetic note for the future development of scientific school teaching was that Pestalozzi himself could barely read. Not that he was a dummy. Those talents simply weren't important in his work. He reckoned his own semi-literacy an advantage in dealing with children destined not to find employment requiring much verbal fluency. 17 agents of the Prussian government acted as Pestalozzi's assistants in Switzerland, bringing insights about the Swiss style of schooling home to northern Germany. While Pestalozzi's raggedy schools lurched clumsily from year to year, a nobleman, von Fellenberg, refined and systematized the Swiss reformer's disorderly notes, hammering the funky ensemble into clarified plans for a worldwide system of industrial education for the masses. As early as 1808, this non-academic formulation was introduced into the United States under Joseph Neef, formerly a teacher at Pestalozzi's school. Neef, with important Quaker patronage, became the principal schoolmaster for Robert Owen's pioneering work utopia at New Harmony, Indiana. Neef's efforts there provided high-powered conversational fodder to the fashionable Unitarian drawing rooms of Boston in the decade.